Welcome aboard. This is Andrew Horowitz. The Disciplined Investor Podcast is what you're listening to, all the way up to episode number 68 in the dog days of summer. We are not only hot outside, but it is gosh darn cold in the markets. Before we get going today, I want to give you a couple bits of information you need to know. We have a lot of great things on the show, including Mike Santoli from Barron's, who we'll be calling him in a few minutes, talking to him about a lot of things about the media I want to ask him about, as well as what's happening in his projections of the markets. But I do want to let you know that this podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of spoken word entertainment. Get a free audiobook download of your choice when you sign up today. You can just simply go to audiblepodcast.com/investor, and you can actually get a free book. I'll tell you about that in a little while, a little bit more about that, and give you the exact URL. And I'm not kidding. It's great. I love it. If you're a podcast listener and you enjoy MP3s kind of on the go, nothing like listening to a good audiobook. I kind of gobble them up as much as I can, because oftentimes it lets you multitask, as I see it. But anyway, we're going to talk here. Let me give you a taste about what we're going to talk about today. We're going to be talking about GM in the auto industry, Crocs. Boy, if I had a sound effect right now like Jim Cramer, it'd be like a Bronx cheer for that one, huh? But I'll give you some details on how we actually called it about a year ago. And if you have been listening for some time, we had been talking about that for an awfully long time. And I'll give you details on exactly, kind of how you can spot those kind of things. We'll talk about Merrill Lynch. And I think it's kind of bugging me about what happened with Merrill Lynch. Well, not only last week, but really how it was presented and buried in the back of the Wall Street Journal. I'll give you some discussion on the Money Show, Strategy Lab, a couple of stock tips. I have a question for you. I need some help. And all that's coming up right now on The Disciplined Investor, episode number 68. Strap on, get ready. Here we go.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
All right, where do we start? Probably a loaded question there, and I got a list of things to talk about before we get into our guest today, which is Mike Santoli from Barron's. But I guess there's so many things that are out there these days that are really kind of really concerning, right? We beat the crap out of the whole area of, the finance and banks and brokers and mortgages and all that. So we'll talk about that, I'm sure, a little bit here. I'll talk about Merrill. But I want to talk to you about the automobile industry. It's been an area, I don't know what your experience has been, but from a consumer standpoint, I can't stand it. I will not go buy a car. I'll get new cars, but I will not actually go visit the dealer. I won't go and talk to the salesman. And if you're a salesman, if you're involved in the automobile industry, I apologize, but the experience is so revolting to me. It is so difficult to go into an automobile dealership, talk to the guy, feel like I'm being browbeat, feel that the sales process is just going to be totally slanted against me, and then, walk out with a questionable deal where I'm concerned that I really, got ripped off somewhere here, that I really wasn't paying attention. Because, it's like you walk out and you got to count your fingers and toes after you leave there to wonder if, did this go the way I think it went? And the automobile industry, I think, when you look at all the things that have happened with the automobile industry, when it comes to the unions and, I've written a few articles on unions and what I think of them and the problems they have. And again, I guess, look back at the unions, and I think there was a real need for them back three decades ago, where we had a real concern about how workers were being treated and the fairness of benefits and everything all involved. But somehow, over the last decade, it morphed into another layer of expenses when it comes to many of the particularly the transportation industry, but others too. And what I mean by that is it seems to have really provided excellent benefits for those that are top of the unions. Yes, unions do solve a purpose. And if you're out there, kind of waiting to just wring my neck, and I hear you, I get it, but let's just step back for one second. If you're a union lover, if you're a union hater, fine. If you think the management of these companies are just absolute bullies and they're taking advantage of the workers, I get it. I get all of it. But at the same time, something is failing. The union won't work, the company won't work, if there is no longer a company. It is in nobody's interest to put this company out of business, whether it's GM, Ford, whether it's any of the airlines, et cetera. So I think that we need to step back for a second and talk about what is the fix for the automobile industry. Because let's take a look. GM put a $15.5 billion loss up last week. Ford put up some ungodly number the week before that. And really, there's no end in sight. But here's what concerns me. Who is steering this ship? Who is looking at 0% financing for GMAC, yet they did this for many years, but yet was selling 8% bonds? There's an 8% loss right there. Now, we talk about floor planning, and we talk about the incentive basis, we talk about the dealers versus the company itself and who's paying what. It is not a good way of doing business. There, first of all, there's too much going into the whole process. There's a lot of things that I think we can get rid of. And what I mean by that is this. Floor planning is horrible. I live in Florida. There are these humongous, humongous dealerships that are just, they're insane. I have a fix. Matter of fact, I've been working on this fix for some time of the automobile industry. And it really has a multiple parts to it. First of all, there's things like getting off the annual change of models. I mean, who thought of this? I mean, why do we have to have a change of model every single year? I think we need to go to a Dell model for computers, a little bit complicated, retooling costs, et cetera. But what we need to do is we need to go into a just-in-time process where instead of having this gigantic dealership where you can go in and just find any car you want, take it off the lot right then and there, we need to step back and realize that's not working. Now, there's argument from the dealers that say, well, you know, the cost of it's being absorbed by the company of the inventory in the lot, but you know what? That's not working. It's just not working. Let's face it. So what we need to do is something like a just-in-time process where there's kiosks at the automobile dealerships. The kiosk can show you any make and model of the car that you want from that dealership. You could change it with the color. It kind of virtualize the experience. And then they have examples on the lot of those cars that you can have, maybe 25 cars on the lot or maybe 50 even at the max. And you could take it for a drive, et cetera. On top of that, we have to look at the fact that the way that they've done leasing is a problem. Well, much of that is over these days, and they're closing that up finally. But when you look at the automobile industry, I've got about a 5-6 point plan. It needs to be totally revamped. And think about it for a second, last week when it was reported that the automobile industry in the U.S. auto sales are down 31% on large cars, they're down 29% on SUVs, midsize, 33% on large, and 32% on small SUVs. And overall, the numbers are when you look at the totals now for a second, you look at total SUVs, they're down close to, let's see, what is this, percent change. 29% from year to date in 2007, and in one year through July, down 42%. They're down. Now, what am I talking about here? Who is at the helm, realizing or not realizing that fuel costs are going through the roof and that SUVs are going to be slowly but surely cut out, and really people aren't going to be driving them? You can't afford them anymore. These people are not paying attention, okay? Wake up. You're ruining an industry. And unless there are significant changes, and one of these days I'm going to actually put up this plan. And as a matter of fact, I'm going to go so far as ask for some help here. Do you have an idea how the automobile industry can change? Because I'm writing this piece. I'll put it up on my site, maybe even on MSN Money. If you have an idea on how the automobile should be changed, short, don't send me an entire 12-page piece, but something short that may be really a key idea, what can change, why don't you send it to me? info@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. But the bottom line is the pain is not going to be over until there's a paradigm shift within the industry itself. And we're not only seeing this, by the way, with U.S. automobile manufacturers, we're seeing this across the board with really the whole world and everybody. But let's also talk about, for example, a similar situation. And I'm going to talk fast through this because I don't want to take up the entire show here. But, you know, we have a jobless rate of, 5.7% right now. And again, when you look at this situation, the automobile manufacturers didn't kind of wake up to this. But we have a company like Crocs. Crocs came out with a number last week that they said that they were going to have a significant reduction to their earnings in the next quarter, and the shares plummeted down to about $4.50 or so at the end of the week. And what's interesting, last summer, if you look back on what I talked about, at $80, at $70, at $60, at $50, I was a lunatic. I was absolutely screaming from the rafters. Anybody that would listen, get out of this stock. Do you remember? I went so far as to actually travel around the world with a camera on my vacations, taking pictures and taking videos. It's on the site. You can take a look at it at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And just put in the search, put in Crocs in there somewhere. But I was talking about how this was a fad, how there is no way this is going to continue, not from the ugly factor and all that. It was apparent. It was evident. Growth was good, but there was no way it was sustainable. But moreover, they were copying these shoes all over the world, and it was going to be a real problem. Then they went out and utilized their money to buy other types of shoes to try to diversify. That was a key that they knew as management that this was not a long term trend. But somehow, a lot of people kind of get caught, got caught with their Crocs down. And what happened last year when I had these several articles and podcasts on this, and I recommended the short on Crocs, I got so much hate mail. I mean, people were like just all over the place and all over me on my back saying, what is wrong with you? You know, why do you hate this? Kind of like what happened with the financials a few months ago when I was ragging on those. But the bottom line is, these are the kind of things as investors, if we pay attention to them, these trends and these cycles and these fads, you know what? Don't get caught up in it. Get caught up in it to a point and ride the wave, if you will, kind of Howard Lindzen style. He says, ride the wave of the trend, right? And then, you know when to get off, kind of get off that train when it's going to stop and crash. And hopefully you did so with Crocs, or at least hopefully maybe you even short with Crocs. But that's the same discussion I had with some of these banks. Same thing that's happening with the automobile industry. It's kind of like, what's happening? The final nail in the coffin on the Crocs, I'll tell you what it was when somebody wrote into me saying that I know nothing about Crocs. The rubber that's being used by Crocs, listen to this, the rubber that's being used by Crocs is so amazing. It's antibacterial. It's in such an incredibly comfortable material that they're actually thinking about making toilet seats out of it. Toilet seats. I said, oh my, that's it. I'm done. I'm out. When the hype and the hyperbole gets to such a point that it's almost, you know, it's laughable. You gotta say, you know what? It's time to kind of step back and really take an account of what's happening. Take a look from a different angle. Is this really something I want to be involved in? So anyway, toilet seats. I don't want to think about it. Anyway, Crocs is kind of a, I just can't imagine where it's going to go from here. But I think that dog is dead. Let me mention to you also about the Money Show while we're at it. You know, I'll be speaking at the San Francisco Money Show that's starting on this coming Friday, which is the 7th. I believe it's the 7th. Let me just take a look here. I have the date here. Let's see. Next Friday, I think it's the 7th. And if you are, hopefully you'll be in town. I mean, I don't know if you're going to have the availability to do so, but if you can, just check out, just look up the Money Show. I'll also put a link to it on our site. Check the search for Money Show. I'd love to see you there. I'm teaching a class on portfolio mastery. We're going to go through all the processes that we use as disciplined investors. And also, on top of that, I'll be a part of the panel for the Strategy Lab. You know, I'm doing that Strategy Lab with Microsoft. So I'm doing the panel there. And I'm going to also be there for book signings, et cetera. As a matter of fact, hey, you know what? If you go and you find me somewhere, leave a message for me at the bookstore there or post a message for me somewhere, and you tell me that you were thinking about buying a Crocs toilet seat, I'll give you a book for free, signed book for free, The Disciplined Investor, Essential Strategies for Success. If you haven't read it yet, I do recommend that you do so. It's given you, I think it'll give you a really good insight into how to, you know, how to really understand these markets and the tools that you need to utilize. It's as we call it, the quanta funda techna, going through the quantitative analysis and screens and finding the stocks, then next stepping into the fundamentals and understanding what's happening. And then finally, on top of it, looking at the technicals. And what I did was, I told you last week about a few stocks that I chose, as a matter of fact, that I recommended. I walked you through it. And then also, if you look at the Strategy Lab, look up Microsoft Strategy Lab that I'm participating, I have about five or six stocks that recently came through the screens, and I gave you my full analysis why I'm actually choosing those. And those are the stocks that we're using. As a matter of fact, over the last couple of weeks, the stocks that we have in our portfolio for the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth strategy is doing quite well. We're actually up about 2.5%, I believe it is, when the markets are down about 4%. So far, so good, knock wood. Lastly, I think this is last on my list. Let's see. Strategy Lab I told you about. Go check that. Oh, by the way, the Strategy Lab, just to mention this, this is an ongoing process for the next 6 months. And if you want to take a look at what we're investing in, how we're investing, it's a little bit different than what we do for our client portfolios through the new Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy, that kind of like hedge fund concept without a hedge fund, right? Where we're managing it in a way that we can go anywhere for growth. And more information is out on the site. Just go check that out. You can find a whole, actually, a 14-minute walkthrough, a virtual walkthrough, if you want to check that out. But The point here is that a lot of that is incorporated into things I'm talking about on the Strategy Lab, just to kind of give you an idea and a flavor for what that is. The last thing I want to talk about today is Merrill Lynch. And it's something I just don't understand. And maybe you can help me out. You know, as a matter of fact, last week I was up in New York, and I got the opportunity to spend some time with Jim Joubak over at Microsoft. I was in the Microsoft office. I went over to Yahoo. I was actually stood up by a quote-unquote buddy of mine over at Yahoo. I don't know what that was about. You know, we had this meeting, and I don't know. We'll chalk it up to miscommunication, but I guess in these days with text messaging and all that. Anyway, I don't want to get into that whole discussion. But the discussion about Merrill Lynch is this, that, you know, last week they came out with this huge problem and solution, supposedly, where they're going to be, I think they had a, you know, an $8.5 billion capital infusion to save their hides, because they're having all sorts of problems with their CDOs and a variety of other areas and aspects of their business, and they needed this bailout. And like they all say, we just need this one, and that's it. We're going to be fine. But Merrill Lynch's plan is very confusing. They're selling some assets at like 22 cents on the dollar. They're utilizing, it looks like, loans from themselves to buy into the process, to bail themselves out. It's kind of like, I mean, it's a little bit of an exaggeration, but, you know, if I go to a bank and I say, you know, I'd like to loan a loan for $1 million, and they say, well, you know, we're looking here and your balance sheet looks pretty weak. We need more assets. I said, okay, you know what? Hang on. I'll be right back. I come back and I show them the balance sheet, and I show there's another $500,000 of assets on there. But really all I did was loan the money to myself, kind of like moved it from one pocket to the other and not really, you know, do anything more than that. And they say, oh, that looks good now. That looks much cleaner. I mean, and again, in an exaggerated sense, Merrill Lynch is going through that process. And really, the whole dealings, I've been talking about this ad nauseum. We talked about it with Mike Shedlock Mish last week or 2 weeks ago. And the financials are just really pulling some real shenanigans here. And I think that the whole Merrill Lynch discussion, which, by the way, was buried on one of the back pages of the Wall Street Journal last week, buried. Really, you had to search for this whole story. And I question why that wasn't front page. I mean, it must have been, you know, the Beijing Olympics and the smog was much more of an important issue, it seems. But nonetheless, the discussion about, you know, what's happening within the brokerage industry, the expansion of the short sale and naked short sale rules, and the protection that's being given them, obviously, you know, the big discussion is that the government is not going to allow them to go bankrupt. Same thing can be discussed about, let's say, GM. You know, the government just can't let them go bankrupt. Well, then again, the same thing could be discussed about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. But where is the point that the government just can't bail out everyone? They've gotten to the level where they've just exhausted a huge, I mean, I think we're at close to a trillion and a half dollars of money that was lost in this whole process. The ability to prop up and to save Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac may really end up being just a nationalization of them and really just owned by the government, which would be bad for some, particularly the stockholders, it seems, and good for the bondholders. But at the same time, you have to wonder where the extent of the value. And by the way, we know that by looking at the dollar. The weaker the dollar is, the more concern there is for the amount of money that's being spent. There's been a lot of discussion about how badly Bernanke is doing. As a matter of fact, Jim Cramer really hit it hard when he talked about Bernanke last week. As a matter of fact, it was really kind of interesting how he just hit him right between the eyes. And if you remember, this is like the 1 year anniversary from the original freak out rant that he had on CNBC where, you know, the famous, he has no idea. And I'm not going to try to strain the vocal cords to get at the level he was at. And, you know, looking back, obviously he had some very valid points, but, you know, you kind of still wonder what's going on and why there's this resistance by the Fed to really kind of spend some time looking at a real solution versus the patch-up, but I don't know, maybe they can't. Two more things. First, I want to tell you a quick story. You know, the iPhone, I have an iPhone. I have the old one, or had the old one. I'll tell you that story. I was on a plane back from New York last week, and I guess the iPhone slipped off my hip and fell on the floor, I suppose. And that was it, gang. It was all over. It seems that they're in high demand and people don't have the decency to return it when found. It seems that it must have slipped and, I don't know, fell down a couple of seats. And we looked everywhere, absolutely everywhere, and I just couldn't believe. As a matter of fact, I went so far as going down to baggage claim. And, you know, I guess in the spirit, maybe that's why it reminded me, in the spirit of what Cramer did with his rant, I got up and I said, excuse me, I will give a reward, $100, anybody that returns my iPhone right now. And nobody came up. You say, well, why, Andrew, why didn't you just call the phone from somebody else's? Well, the idiot me, I put it on airplane mode because I'm told to. I guess that's a stupid idea, right? But anyway, some woman from across the carousel looks at me and says, maybe if you offer more money. I said, wait a minute. I said, do you have my iPhone? Oh, no. Needless to say, I didn't get it back. But the good news is, this is really cool. I went to the AT&T store. They had none. They're not going to have for about 2 to 3 weeks. Went over to the Apple store down on the Galleria and waited in line. My daughter actually waited in line for me. When I got there, they wouldn't sell her a phone. It's not in her name. It's the security on this thing is unbelievable. So what happened was I ended up buying the new phone. I don't necessarily think the 3G is so much faster, but I got to tell you, this location-based processing where you can find things on the fly is just unbelievable. And the apps are extraordinary. I encourage you, if you haven't checked it out yet, check it out. And this is a monumental device. This really is an amazing, amazing device. And the cool news is, you know how when you buy a phone, oftentimes, the old-fashioned phones at least, your data is, you know, from one phone to the next is just difficult at best to get it on. Well, I had backed up my iPhone about an hour before I got on the plane. Absolutely everything was completely and 100% restored to my iPhone. So I thought that was really cool, and I was really happy. Anyway, we still maintain a hold on Apple. We still have some great calls against it, and I think that doing that in this environment was really a great move, especially because Apple holds a huge premium on their preferreds. And finally, let me just go down this list here and see what we have here. I think I ended everything here. I will mention one more time before we get started, then we'll give a call. Two things. Number one, I told you last time, it looks like maybe at the end of August, we're going to kind of slow down some of the new reservations that are coming in because we have a backlog of reservations. People that had expressed an interest, people that signed up for the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth strategy. If you haven't checked it out, go over to the site, the Disciplined Investor, and just click it on, see the virtual tour. It's $50,000 minimum. It is really neat because what we're also doing is there's full transparency on your personal account when we manage it for you. But what we're doing also is we have a private website, a blog set up so you can track not only what we're doing, but I give you educational tips on exactly what it is and why it is and why something came through the screen or maybe why we're buying ESI, ITT Educational, the whole background of why we're buying it, but also looking at some charts and things like that. So that's, people are really liking that. But what I think may happen is if it goes at this pace, we are going to temporarily probably slow down taking on new money, and we'll see how that goes back at the end of August or so. We'll have to see. But I would suggest, because what we're going to do is we're going to take out the first line of reservations. So anybody, if you're listening, if you put a reservation and you haven't gone through the whole process to, you said you wanted forms and you have the forms and all to sign up to the account, I would make a recommendation. We're going to kind of turn it around and just start from the beginning again, if you will. And if you haven't done so already, it's kind of time you want to do so, and I'll be happy to talk to you about it when we get to that point, if you do want to do that. But the other thing is, and I'll finish on this, Audible. I told you I was reading a book. I read, I read a book a month or so on that. But what's really cool about Audible, if you go to Audible, and simply you go to audiblepodcast.com/investor, and you can sign up for a 2-week free account. And simply what it does is, you have to give your credit card, but you can cancel at any time. Essentially, you get a free book. You get a free audiobook. Check it out if you like it. And whether you want to read for pleasure, there's some great books out there for pleasure. If you want to read for entertainment in terms of something smaller and just something quick, or if you want to read for education, I mean, there's so many things out there. What I'd recommend very strongly, for example, is maybe if you can get your hands on one of the William O'Neill books, or if you can get your hands on I loved listening to Bill Clinton's book a couple of years back. But let me tell you a book that I would highly recommend. The book is called IBM and the Holocaust. And it's a discussion about IBM's participation and how IBM enabled the Germans of the time, the Nazis, to really ramp up the slaughter of the Jews and non-Jews during World War II's Holocaust. Essentially, what they did was, because they had the computers and the key cards, even though they weren't allowed to do business directly, there was a couple, I think the company's name, I think it's Dechemag, that's how you pronounce it. Anyway, whatever the company was, they created this company that allowed IBM to do business in Germany and create the lists and the punch cards for the train schedules to the various to Auschwitz and Buchenwald and just all the various extermination camps. And everybody asked all the time, you know, how did they know? How did they know who was where? Well, a few years before, I think it was 1939, I guess it was, they did a census and they found out all this information because they had the computers through IBM and the punch cards through IBM, who made a bloody fortune on it. It enabled the Nazis to really round them up. IBM and the Holocaust. It's a free book. You can get it. Check it out at audiblepodcast.com. That's audiblepodcast.com/investor. It's a free offer that you'll get. It'll redirect you right to the right place. I would encourage you to check it out. That is a really wild book. When we get back on The Disciplined Investor, I think we passed through all the things I want to talk about. We have upcoming in a bit, the Zach Zone IPOs. We're going to talk about some of those. And also Mike Santoli from Barron's. So stick around. There's more coming on The Disciplined Investor podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
All right, we're going to be talking some investments, some money, and all sorts of good things with my good friend Mike Santoli from Barron's. Mike, what is going on? How is it up there in New York? Kind of hot?
Yeah, it's very hot. It's also very slow. I feel like a lot of people doing the summer break thing. So attendance in the market is not what it typically is.
I guess maybe that's good. People aren't not as many people to panic.
Yeah, seemingly. I think people didn't have to be persuaded to check out for a little while given this market.
Yeah. So let me ask you. I was up there last week and I was kind of looking around and talking to some people, and actually an interesting piece came out I think yesterday on the real problems with many of the municipalities and all. And I kind of put together, albeit a pretty depressing concept here. This is the first cycle, I think, that New York in particular is going to find that the bonuses from Wall Street are going to be different than they were in the past, let's say, you know? Because if they're on a calendar year cycle, what happens is, if they're on a calendar year cycle, what's going to happen is obviously this bonus is going to be small or nothing. Compared to last year, we're still kind of in the whole throes of it all. And it really wasn't at a point, I don't think, that people were really going to get their bonuses cut. So now my number that I'm hearing is something about $9, $10 billion of shortfall due to maybe unemployment and losses. And there's going to be like this lack of money coming to the New York State economy and taxes. And I just have this interesting question. What is that going to mean for not only people that live there, but also the state itself?
You know, it's definitely a shock, and you know they're trying to get ahead of it a little bit. I mean, it was very much foreseeable for a while, and now you have a mayor who of New York City who knows a little bit something about Wall Street economics, Mayor Bloomberg, and I think he's sort of been talking to the governor here and says, you know, we have to kind of sound the panic alarm. It's also obviously coming on top of in general, municipalities struggling with the complete dearth of real estate turnover-related tax income and fee income. And so these guys were, almost New York State was almost, in the worst of it, even though it seemed like it evaded the worst of the housing bubble. I think it maybe is just a lagged effect. And it's because of these not only, lower bonuses, certainly sharply negative trend in absolute dollar amount paid on Wall Street, but obviously I think we're looking at tens of thousands of layoffs. So yeah, it's definitely sort of crisis time, and doesn't do great things, I think, for general sentiment in terms of state finances, but also in terms of the muni market. It's obviously something that I think has been kind of hovering over it for some time now. I think the state up here is talking about selling off some of the infrastructure assets, the New York State Thruway, bridges, tunnels. It's kind of like, let's rattle through the couch cushions to see what we can come up with.
Right. I mean, we're talking about when you hear somebody saying, "Hey, do you want to buy the Brooklyn Bridge?" It's serious. I mean,
exactly.
And
it really is.
It's unbelievable. Now, so but if the, let's just take a tunnel here or there or a bridge. So a bridge has maybe a revenue that's coming through because of tolls and all that. How do they sell that off? I mean, are they going to be able to do that, or is it going to be something new they're going to have to dream up? And then also, if they do, I mean, why does somebody want to? This is the big issue I have. Why does everybody believe, when I say everybody, I guess the management and the accountants, that no matter how bad something is, you could sell your asset off to somebody?
Yeah. Well, interestingly, I think in this limited case, it happens to be true, and it's because of a current, you know, I don't know if you want to call it a trend, a fad, or what, in the institutional investment area, which is now considering things like infrastructure, like toll roads, even things like parts of the electrical grid as an asset class. And you have actually seen municipalities and states around the country sell off the toll roads to some private company, which then basically becomes this sort of income-producing investment for some fund or some group of funds or pension funds, et cetera. But it's a one-shot deal, obviously. Right. I mean, it's not as if the state then can, you know, pull royalties off it over a long period of time. It's basically, oh, you save on the direct cost of, you know, of maintaining the thing. But no, it's not something that I think should be taken lightly. And if it's a decent investment over a long period of time, that would imply that the state itself over the long term should, you know, hang on to it and use that revenue stream.
Which then again tells us what really the problem is. And I guess, I mean, we could possibly, you know, turn the governor's mansion into a kind of a weekend rental. I mean, that's possible, right?
Yeah. It's possible. I don't know how much demand there is in Albany. I'm not sure if you've been to Albany.
Sell off the subways. I mean, it's just pathetic. But actually, the reason why I bring that up is that I'm always looking for the next possible, you know, up or down. These days, down is a little bit easier. But, you know, I'm thinking way back to the time when New York almost went bankrupt under, I guess it was it Koch?
Or it was Abe Beam.
Oh.
Right before Koch.
I always get Koch and Frank Perdue mixed up, so I don't know.
Yeah, right.
You know? So, but we had the problem. Seriously, there was, you know, the bankruptcy or the potential bankruptcy and the problems in New York. Could that happen again? And if so, I'm thinking, where's the great, you know, good investment? Do we short one of these ETF or / closed-end muni bond funds of New York?
You know, it's probably a little bit less dire than it was back then, mostly because the state and the city have, you know, a better handle on their ability to cut back on costs. It's not painless. It's not easy. But back then, you were talking about union contracts that locked you into double-digit, you know, compensation increases and prohibited layoffs for a long period of time. Now, that being said, I think that there's a very, very much a longer term aspect of this, which is, you know, the reason that there's this mismatch, but, you know, in government finances across the board is obviously this demographic bulge that is just not going to accommodate the continued level of spending or tax revenue. So this complete mismatch with all these commitments to retirees, pensioners, and such are just only going to grow. And I do think that nobody's quite reckoning with all that. In a real kind of holistic way. It's more just kind of putting out fires when they arise. Now, I don't, you know, I certainly can't tell you whether, you know, a state closed-end muni fund is a good short here, but I can tell you that, you know, it would be if it trades at any kind of a premium, which I doubt in this environment.
Exactly. All right, let's, there's been some hubbub about the Barron's covers, the timeliness of it. I think we saw GM come out with some very awful number, $15 billion or something, or whatever. You know, a billion here, a billion there. Who cares at this point, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and Ford, you know, came out with its worst earnings ever. And I happen to have a plan to fix the entire auto industry. It's a pipe dream, but that's a different story.
Okay.
So you know, Barron's is been a little bit under the gun with calling some of the bottoms of late. It seems.
Yeah.
You know. Okay. So, you know, whether it's today, tomorrow, you know, a month. I mean, it's close enough to be honest with you. Truly, it is. If it is getting towards a bottom, I don't have a problem. I have a question for you though. It seems to me that, you know, I watch every once in a while like a Brian Westbury who just will not allow the fact of a recession to come to his lips. And I watched him on Thursday and Friday this week and saw him or Friday maybe it was that he said that, you know, everything is fine in the economy. Everything is being blown out of proportion.
Yeah.
What am I missing?
That's certainly not our stance, and I do think that he's of the camp that that really will be the last to capitulate to the idea that there is, if nothing else, a very severe consumer recession going on right now that seems to be bleeding into, you know, more of a broad-based business recession now. I'm not that preoccupied personally with the statistician's definition and the academic declaration of whether it's an official recession or not. It feels like it. Obviously, on the consumer side, it is. 7 straight months of job losses. But when it comes to the market, and that's where we kind of come in terms of, you know, basically kind of with these early calls that that maybe a bottom was in for a sector or for whatever, or for, you know, a big stock like GM, which is clearly an ill-conceived and ill-timed call. although we did, in about the second sentence, say it could be a zero.
Right.
But now, that being said, I think it mostly is a matter of people who are contrarian, which we attempt to be, and who are sensitive to, you know, when stocks get cheaper, you should actually be looking to buy more of them when they go down 20%, in general. We're susceptible to value traps. I mean, that's just, I will be first to concede that. And I do agree with you that some kind of a bottom market-wise is in at least close in time, if not in price, you know, because these things so easily can overshoot. That, you know, I do think that on a multi-year basis, you can do fine when the market's, you know, giving you a 20% discount. On an immediate basis, you can look incredibly stupid. Because, as I say, I define a bear market as one where the overshoots happen on the downside, as opposed to a bull market where they almost always go too high, mm-hmm. beyond some kind of a fair value measure. And I've believed for a while that the overall stock market, measured by, you know, the broad indexes, don't necessarily have to really collapse from recent levels to account for the likelihood of a recession, severe, you know, even somewhat severe consumer recession, because we never got incredibly overvalued the way we did in the early part of the decade.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting, you know, you look back in the early part of the decade when we had this official recession, and most consumers, you know, were barely aware of it. I mean, the consumption trend did not really budge that much. Yeah, of course, you had a bulge in unemployment, but most people were still happily driving SUVs around and buying new ones, etc. This time, but yet the stock market got cut in half, okay, over a couple of years.
Yeah, sure.
This time, I think the consumer has been much more quick to see the effect. It's very consumer-centric, and we have an S&P 500 that is, you know, largely business to business. We've taken $1.5 trillion out of the financials market cap. We've taken $500 billion out of the consumer discretionary sector market cap. The market has gone some distance toward building in where the problems are. And the S&P's 40% non-U.S. earnings, probably going higher than 40%. So I do think that explains this perceived mismatch between, you know, okay, what's the stock market telling us or not telling us, and the economic reality, which is I don't think you can escape the fact that, you know, this is a consumer recession and these GDP numbers are lagging.
Well, the thing is, though, that if you go back and just one of the statements you made was that, you know, when stocks are down 20% or whatever the exact number is, that may be a buying opportunity, et cetera. I think that's very old school, I'll be honest with you. I think that, you know, mm-hmm. obviously I'm not here saying, you know, oh, you know, trying to ride the train of it's a bear market and, you know, things about, you know, listen, I've been talking to you about this for a long time, the problems mm-hmm. out there. And I just find that these days people just don't want to, it's not a capitulation. They don't want to admit, and it's very tough to talk about the downside. Listen, I got a question for you. You know, I find, and you and I have talked about a lot of things, and, you know, when it comes to the short side of the equation and things that look bad, it doesn't seem that, you know, a lot of people want to talk about that, you know, and I'm not going to go over each of the points, but, you know, I mean, it seems that there's a definite bias towards the long and buy side. Now, maybe that's because, whether it's Barron's or any other magazine or paper or television or whatever it is, that, you know, the idea of talking about shorts is kind of like people get this really weird idea about things, right? You know, the public.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the public starts sure. freaking out about stuff. You know, oh, my God, they're talking down about a stock. And, you know, back a year and a half ago, I was freaking out about Crocs. I mean, I had like 15 posts that I did about Crocs.
Which we wrote a negative
yeah.
story about.
Right. No, right. But I'm saying, but the problem is, the point was more so about the public. They start freaking out. How dare you talk about
that? They have a visceral response to it. They think that you're corrupt somehow and your motivations are somehow suspect. Look, we get that a lot. And I'm just going to point out that, you know, of all the outlets out there, we actually are associated most with a willingness to take on the short side. So we had cover stories on the impending bust in housing in June of 2005.
Right.
Cover stories saying short, you know, MGIC.
Mm-hmm.
In the 60s, short MBIA in the 60s. So we were kind of there at that part of the curve, and I do think that the broader reason why, you know, there's this demonization of the short side is, first of all, the vast majority of people are not participating there.
Mm-hmm.
If they're thinking about looking for potential places for their money, they are going to be, it's going to be passive long only in general.
Right.
Now, even with all the hubbub about, you know, the shorts and trying to make them the villains, short interest is less than 6% of New York Stock Exchange shares outstanding.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's not the predominant reason stocks go down.
Sure.
And it's prudent to participate on that side on some level. But when I see things like the double inverse financial sector ETF, SKF, and you see the trading volumes in that, it's become a little bit less taboo to bet against these things. It's just a matter of, you know, I think it's more a matter of, you know, when investor sentiment is, even though you think people don't talk enough about the negative and the threats and the challenges, investor sentiment is just despondent right now.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it should be. In other words, it's not as if in a bull market when investors get negative, that's a divergence. That means, okay, probably we're going to go a bit higher. This just means I think there's a recognition out there that that things aren't great. And look at fund flows. It's not as if people are throwing new money at stock mutual funds. They're pulling it out. You look at money market assets, they're at a record as a percentage of stock market capitalization back to something like early 2003 levels. So I think there is a more generalized sense that things are tough. And I think the challenge is for us and for, you know, anybody who cares to try and play the game is when is enough is enough? When is the market properly discounted? And, you know, I don't think we've quite gotten there. I mean, I don't see what's going to persuade the people who've been mindful of all these things that there's a turn and that we're going to see some light at the end of the tunnel. I really do think it's going to take a while.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that when the, you know, I just did a calculation that of the 40 most widely held stocks, you know, even though the indexes in a year aren't down terribly much. Yeah, they went down 20% from the highs, but on a 12-month basis, you know, we're actually down, I don't know what it is, 11% or something like that.
On the major markets or on the
yeah.
Market? Yeah, uh-huh.
Yeah, on the
right.
Major market.
Mm-hmm.
I should actually have this.
That's about right. That's about right.
52
I mean, I
weeks,
say,
down 15. It's about 13-14%. Well, you're down 20% in the average of the 40 most widely held stocks.
Right. Which is, by the way, what I've been complaining about, because here's what I've been saying. The fact is that the mom and pops have been getting cremated. I mean, the
right.
People that have been of the buy and hold. You know, listen. If you own GE, generally you would never sell it. GE was not a stock.
Right.
GE was a piece of furniture. You know what
right.
I mean? I mean, you bought GE. Nobody, you don't sell GE. And I talked to people. I said,
right.
Do you know what happened to GE? And the problem I'm having now is, and this is more of a just a, you know, from stepping back for a moment, that all these people are cremated in these stocks, and so many brokers are using these lines like, you know, over the past 20 years and time, da, 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 or, you know what, buy and
yeah.
hold, or it's a good time to buy, or I can give you the 20 different things that they're talking about that we are so trained to do. And by the way, I'm going to blame it on the mutual funds, because the mutual funds
right.
have brainwashed everybody that buy and hold is the only way to go and trading is bad. And I'm going to further you, Mr. Santoli, I'm going to tell you, and I'm going to ask you this question. I think that generally the buy and hold strategy has been put upon us to keep the markets from having excess volatility so that those that trade around it on a daily basis or on a basis can have more control and not worry about the markets just falling out from under them, you know, whether it's Goldman, whether it's Merrill, whether, you know, any of the market making rooms. And I think that it's a bunch of crap, to be honest with you, to have people just buy into the fact that they never sell anything.
Well, I think that the buy and hold ethos has been cracked. To a large degree. By that I mean, as I said, people are not listening to the, to the 20-year average annual return thing. At the top of the market, when buy and hold in 2000, when buy and hold was definitely at its peak of all time, and the market was about to be cut in half, you had the survey said that people expected the market to go up 20% a year.
Right. Exactly.
That right now. I mean, it's insane, but that right now is. People don't expect, you know, the market to give them much. And I actually think that's a healthy thing. Now, look, I agree with you that there's a sort of financial services industry, you know, vested interest in just getting your assets and keeping them there and taking a fee off them all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It's not I don't think it's because, oh, let's make sure there's a bid under the market, but it as much as it is, we make money when you put it in and don't take it out. But, I pointed out recently that, you know, in June of 1998, or July of 1998.
98, okay.
The 98,
right.
The market hit, the S&P hit 1190.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, at the low recently, we're 1,200.
Well, look at the NASDAQ. Okay? It's still down 50% from the high.
Right.
It's pathetic.
Right. But, I mean, and the S&P was supposed to be kind of the more right. blue-chippy.
Right.
What that tells you is that I think we've, you know, it takes a long time. And I mean, these things, I mean, in 1999, you know, Buffett was talking about the 17-year cycles, okay? We were up for 17 years. Oddly enough, that seems to work over history. We still got a while to go. And if there's one healthy thing that comes out of it, I think that one of the kind of injustice, well, one of the things that we did wrong in the financial media and obviously the industry in general was we gave people the impression that the market itself was going to do your saving for you.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't a matter of, okay, you need to, you know, actively set more aside. You need to take control of, you know, kind of like your spending / saving equation because, you know, In the old days, of the 90s, the market was going to take that little sliver of $10,000 and make it a fortune.
Right.
And, you know, that, I mean, again, it's going to take more than even just, you know, 10 years of a flat market to get us around that.
Right.
But, you know, I guess my point is we're getting there. And my other point is, you know, if I'm writing weekly, part of my audience cares about the next 100 feet of pavement in front of us.
Right.
And, you know, I don't pretend to be able to really forecast it very well, but there's a much larger, you know, as you point out, the industry that's preoccupied with essentially trading the short-term noise has never been bigger. It gets bigger every day in terms of assets, in terms of the percentage of, you know, trading volume and all the rest of it. And that's trench warfare. That's a zero-sum game, and these guys are handing the same few percent back and forth to mm-hmm. one another all
right,
the time.
Right.
And so, you know, you have to kind of, you know, split your focus between people who care about certain things and those who care about others. But if you ask me, you know, is it early to say that American Express was a buy at 40? Yep. But in if you care about a 5-year hold, you know, you probably should be satisfied to buy it at 40 and then 35. If you care to do it, it's not as if it's you know, an imperative. And I always say that individuals should forget about beating the market. I mean, if you're not paid to beat the market, first of all, it can't be done consistently, so don't try.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, just to allocate in an intelligent way and, you know, be systematic about it. And, you know, I think just play smaller in terms of exposures to, you know, any one sector, asset class, whatever.
Right. Well, I agree. I mean, I think there's going to be, there was once, and I think there's going to be a big fallout again to mainstream media, with all due respect. Sorry. You know, I still hold you guys in high regard, but I'm not really talking about you necessarily, your paper and all that.
Yeah.
But I think there's going to be a big fallout. I have a different question for you. So, you know, back in February of 2008, I wrote a 16-point a futuristic look at something. I was at a conference up in New York, and there was some very apparent issues, particularly about Citibank and a few others, run on the bank scenario that was building, student loan crisis, 16 points. So I thought that out of, to help people, really. I mean, I wasn't shorting anything necessarily on that list, right?
Right.
You know, I sent it to my local guys that I know down at the Sun Sentinel, the Florida Sun Sentinel. And like 10 times I talked to them. As a matter of fact, Howard Greenberg is Greenberg. He's the brother of the famous gentleman. Not Greenberg? No. You know, he just left.
Hank Greenberg.
Hank. He's his brother. And, you know, he said that they'll do something with it. And all I said, nothing ever happened. And I said, you know, the big problem is that we're looking at current situations rather than looking forward and seeing what's happening. So, and I direct this a little bit about to you as well, you know, and we've talked about this, but I just wonder that if I find something that I find to be really either helpful for a lot of different reasons and maybe something that's very apparent, you know, one of those like very clear moments, right? You know, you see mm-hmm. something like my VMware. It was very clear what was going to happen because it was kind of like written on a piece of paper in front of me.
Right.
But, you know, you and I went back and forth on Capital One and not right or wrong. Who knows in the next 2 years
sure.
who's going to be right or wrong in this discussion. And I pounded you pretty hard on that, right? I did. I was kind of like,
sure.
look. How do I, maybe not you, and talk about somebody else. You know, this guy down is Paul Owens, Owers, whatever his name is, that I couldn't get through to him. How do I, as someone who may be viewed as having a bias, et cetera, how do I get through to somebody and say, you know what, I think people need to know about this? You know, what do I have to do to try to convince somebody?
You know, I don't know that there's magic. I think it's kind of like, you know, catching them at a, you know, at a fortuitous moment is one way. But also, I think that to lay it out when you lay out a thesis, you know, kind of in a sober and thorough way,
mm-hmm.
and present it that way. And then, you know, I actually have become a big believer in the power of repetition. In other words, people kind of don't remember when you tell them the first time, and even if you were right. And, you know, so reminders with new, whatever new information might come through. But also, yeah, I don't know how to establish, you know, initial credibility. I don't know. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, it's one of those, it's one of those things where, you know, you encounter a lot of noise. Half, you know, some of the noise is going to be, is going to be, you know, right. And, but not all the stuff that seems right is always worth listening to. Right. So I don't know. I don't think there's a magic way to do it.
I'm just frustrated because I have brought several things to a few friends and people that I know. And again, you and I have talked about this point. That doesn't mean anything has to be done with it. I know that. I get that point.
Gotcha.
I totally get that. But, you know, I talk about oil at the top. I mean, I've been yelling and screaming about this freaking Enron loophole before anybody even – not before anybody. I don't mean to say it like that.
Right.
But before it started really kind of getting some wind going. I got this guy Greenberger on my show and all this. And here's what the – and let me tell you what this point is. So somebody asked me to write a little piece on it, right, on the whole mm-hmm. oil issue and why I'm going against and why there's speculation. And I mentioned this before, but – you will not believe this, and maybe you will, but I had the discussion, a one or two sentence discussion about the Enron loophole, blah, 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 blah. And it came back to me that that had to be struck because most people don't know what it is, and we really can't bring into this article things that people don't know about. I said, what the hell's the point of it? What are we talking about?
That's a structural weakness of, you know, any kind of media or anything like that that seeks, you know, a somewhat broad audience. I mean, you're capped out in terms of the level of, you know, insight or sophistication you can bring to it. I mean, we sort of deal with that all the time.
Right.
Doesn't make it right or any less frustrating. It's just, you know, I'm sure that's, just.
Yeah, I hear you. I just hope that, you know, moving forward, I'm not directing this at you, but since, you know,
I just find that,
you know, we got, maybe what's happened is that this whole blogging war against mainstream media has somehow had a negative effect on mainstream media, and whether they're changing or do, I don't know what it is, but I'm just,
well, look, you know. I will point one thing out, which is, I think that I mean, mainstream media and MSM and whatever is now become so far beyond a cliche. And I think what we bristle against is being lumped in with effectively the worst, most, you know, kind of backward, corrupt element of mainstream media. No matter, there's no distinctions made, good,
right,
bad,
right,
or not.
Right.
And I think that's, and look, bloggers, I think, have gone way too far in sort of, their whole reason for being is to prop up the straw man of mainstream media and then bring it down.
Right, right, right.
And
let's admit the fact that most of these, even the top bloggers, all they do is cut and paste your article and comment on it. That's crap. I mean, where's the originality of that? That's terrible.
Right. I agree.
I mean,
I think there was somebody pointed out that, I don't know if it's somebody doing something on Slate or whatever, and it was supposed to be like the news you should be reading in the media, but you're not. And it turns out it's kind of, everything was somewhere in general, you know, kind of traditional media before it appeared there. So anyway,
all right. So it's not
a war that I find worth fighting, but I think your observation might be somewhat right that there's a level of resistance put up
mm-hmm.
By folks in, you know, in the media who, you know, or just a little too defensive, you know, when it comes to the presentation. But the other thing you should ask yourself, why is it important to you to get there?
To get
recognized and exposed in that forum. I mean,
there's only one reason. There's two reasons, actually. You know, obviously, it's you know, it's if there's something on one hand that could be important that needs to get out there, whatever that is. I mean, whatever.
Sure.
Like for example, my 16 points were kind of a different kind of breed. That was kind of like, hey, really, people wake up. There's something happening, something coming, and people need to be aware of this. That was really not more than it wasn't any particular stock, no particular. You know, there wasn't really. That was a different thing. The other thing, to be honest with you, is that, you know, the goal is to get a little bit of name recognition out there because
right.
you know, I could be the best guy, and I could be telling you that VMware at 100 it drops to 50. I could tell you about Capital One at 50 it drops to 30. I could tell you 20 different things, but you know, if I'm barking over here, you guys have the audience.
Right.
You know, you have the audience. So the only way that, you know, and you got, be honest with you, these retards on CNBC that are constantly talking about the same thing over and over and over, I don't know why they keep on bringing them back. But okay, that's their choice.
Well, because they're willing to come on, and that's a big part of
that. That may be.
It's really, I mean, you shouldn't overestimate the laziness as a cause of a lot of these bookings.
Right,
you know?
Right. And the reason why it's important, to be honest with you, is right or wrong, first, it's develop credibility for me as a money manager. So when I hock you on something, all right, yeah, no, I hock you. Listen, I hocked you to a point I almost, you know, flew up to New York on Capital One. I was pretty brutal on that, I thought.
Right.
You know, and, you know, we went back and forth, and I'm not sure if it got to a point that we were kind of battling, so that kind of clouded it or not. I don't know that answer, but no, whatever. It doesn't matter, right or wrong. It's not the point. The point is, at the end of the day, the end game is obviously, and if you don't want to, I mean, obviously, this is the point. And it's across the board. If I can get some kind of recognition in a Barron's or whatever it is, it's good for me. You know, that's that's the game. So if I can come
there, it's not that it undermines it at all. It's just, I'm just, you know.
That's why it's important. I mean, so, but the truth of the matter is, you know, that it's kind of, over the last number of months, it's lost its flavor. You know, with all the things that I've kind of thrown out there to people, and then it's not being picked up at all. And frankly, again, and I'll end on this one point that I want your future look on something. But, you know, when I was back talking about Crocs a year and a half ago, screaming at the top of my lungs, and I look back on it, I realize how little people picked up on any of that from any angle. It doesn't have to be like I was the one. I'm not saying that. But just somebody saying, hey, look, by the way, that was kind of cool. You know, just look at that. It's at five now. But it's just, it's kind of, it gets the point home that it's not a pure system. It's just, it's not.
Certainly not.
You know?
No. So, but the problem, too, is, I mean, you know, look, first of all, I thankfully never said go buy Capital One at 50 because I was fully cognizant of. But here's the thing: at some point, when you have this long trending macro driven orientation to the market, that's been, you know, it's been long oils and short financials for however long.
Right.
You're going to be right about a financial going from 50 to 30 in the same way that somebody was right that Cisco was going to go from 50 to 70 in 99. Okay. In other words, because you know it's the blow off move,
right?
And I think that's what a lot of people. Well, at least when it comes to me, it's not about I don't want to give this guy the platform. It's more like I'm nervous of being the last guy having to being the last guy to sort of like overplay that hand.
Well, I hear you. I'm with you. Again, I'm not, but let me just finish on this point. So moving forward, and we look at the financials or whatever's going on there. And by the way, I don't even want to get into my discussion about the lies and the things that are going on, the Merrill bull crap that's going on and all that. But what's your projection moving forward? Not an absolute. I'm saying, is a lot of the stuff that's happening very concerning still to you, or are things starting to clean up?
They're still concerning, but I think I'm kind of segging from being concerned about, pure solvency and this total malfunctioning of the capital markets, which I think is the part that is working its way through. You see things like you find all kinds of fault with the mechanism of Merrill Lynch kind of like pretending they're selling this this paper at a higher price than they are. Or today's news that Ambac and Citi basically said tear up this hedging contract and we'll just pay you some money to get out of it. This is all the kind of like. This is the undertaker work for the credit boom, but I think what I am concerned about is these business models are completely upside down.
Yeah.
Nobody knows what the business is going to be right now.
Right.
They've raised all kinds of capital. They've diluted the heck out of everybody, And it's in terms of the financial services industry. I know there's going to be another new hot thing that these guys chase and it'll actually, let them recover for a while. I just don't think it's going to come for a while, and I can't foresee exactly what it's going to be, because in 2001, I don't think anybody was saying, CDOs, structured finance, that's the only game in town.
Yeah, I think what they're doing is they're going after a different market, in my opinion, taking some money and locking up energy markets. And I don't know, I don't know how close you follow this Enron loophole thing.
Right. Sure.
I just find it to be nauseating that the whole thing was closed up except for oil. So I don't get it.
Right.
I think I must be stupid, honestly. I just the whole thing, or naive. Maybe I'm totally naive or something.
Well, I've seen the lobbying and sort of PR work that the ICE and the guys who were involved in that game have been phenomenally aggressive.
Yeah,
phenomenal.
It's unbelievable. And the good news is that we're personally short here on that whole thing, making a lot of money. Blue chips to cow chips is the theory there. And finally, there was one thing I want. Oh, the other thing I want to mention to you is my father. Real quick, 2 seconds. My father-in-law goes into a bank yesterday. There's a CD, Bank United, 5%. I said, okay, 5% for 1 year. Go have a good time. So mm-hmm. he goes and, you know, I explained to him why they're offering 5%. They're not going to offer, you know, that's their way of doing a secondary offering. They, you know, they're mm-hmm. offering CDs and getting higher. Then he goes in, he gets pointed to another desk. He's told that he can get a tax-free that's guaranteed totally for 5%. This is what he's told. And I'm thinking, mm-hmm. oh, that I want some of that. You know, and it turns out that this woman who's not licensed gave me a 5 minute discussion of how great these things are. They're anywhere from 5 to 7%, totally guaranteed on a 1 to 2 year basis, any time period you want. And obviously, we know that's not true. You know, his 10,000, he's going to have to spend 6% more to get something like that. But I think the next thing they're going to do is pump up their lobby brokers again and go after different markets, try to lock it up. And this is going to be the biggest bet. This is the old, you know what? I'm down to my last quarter here. Put it on 27 straight up.
Right.
You know what I mean? And that's what's hopefully going to win. And if not, you're going to bust out. So,
right. Well, I mean, look. The only way they get out of that is if the Fed pulls a early '90s trick of let's just artificially keep this yield curve where it is, and that's not going to sustain the profit levels these guys need to replenish their capital.
Yep.
But it can nurse them along for a while.
Yep, I hear it. Mike Santoli, Barron's, thank you so much for joining me. We'll talk soon, buddy.
You got it. Thanks.
Right, ciao. It's time for the Zach Zone with Zachary Scheidt. Zach is a portfolio manager at Stearman Capital and blogs at ZachStocks.com.
Well, hey, Andrew. We have a brand new month. Welcome to August.
Hey.
You got a lot going on this month. I'm excited to see how the Strategy Lab thing works out.
Me too.
You got a great approach, and I think you're going to be pretty competitive with the other guys there. So it'll be fun to see how things shake out.
No pressure.
The market has a lot going on, too. I think there's a lot at stake as to whether the financials are going to be able to pull out, whether we've got Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae going to be bailed out, whether things are going to turn around for energy or not. There's just so much kind of riding right now, and if the market's going to have a positive year, they've got to get started right now.
Right now, I agree.
One IPO that we had last week was a pretty interesting. Well, let's just call it what it was. It was a dud. We expected that. China Distance, ticker symbol DL. They priced 8.7 million shares at $7 a piece, and now they're down nearly to six. And I wouldn't try to be a bargain hunter here. I wouldn't consider this to be a good investment until it gets back over the IPO price. They could be a decent company if they grow earnings and they grow revenue, but there's too much that you just don't know yet. So I would stay away from this one. We had one secondary of note last week that worked out pretty well. This is Insight Corp, ticker symbol INCY, and they priced 10.5 million shares at $9 a piece. Now, they closed the week at $9.63, so it was a decent return for those who got involved on the secondary offering. This is actually a money-losing drug developer. The company, basically, they're trying to find some good remedies for HIV and some other diseases, and they've got some neat ideas, but so far they're losing money, and they're losing more money every month. So being able to raise new capital with the secondary offering kind of helped them stay alive to fight another day. But I don't think that there's just a lot of danger in the stock, so I definitely would not buy it now. And it could be a good short opportunity. If the stock drops below $9, you can expect people who bought the secondary to go ahead and start bailing out. And so below $9 a share, I think this thing is a short, and I think you can make a lot of money on it. So put it on your radar listing. Keep an eye on it. We have a very interesting week coming up next week. I think it's still critical for the market to hold up if we're going to see any traction, if we're going to see any positive movement, a positive year in the market, and if we're going to see any IPOs that actually price well and do well long term. There are three IPOs on the list for next week. The first one is China Mass Media, ticker symbol CMM. If this sounds familiar, it was actually on the list for last week, and they bumped it. They basically delayed it based on market conditions, and they're hoping to bring it out this week. When they delay an IPO, that's not a good sign. That really means that they had a hard time finding investors, and so they had to take their time and look for more people that are willing to buy the stock. So I would not buy into China Mass Media if you can help it. It's just not worth the risk. The second IPO is Rhino Resource Partners, ticker symbol RNO. These guys are a limited partnership, and they own coal properties and other energy assets, and to be quite honest, there's too much uncertainty in the energy market right now to make a call. It could end up that this is a decent company to own long term, but I would not be buying them right now. The risk reward is not good. There's not an edge here. There's not a reason to buy because you just don't know what's going to happen. So stay away from Rhino Resource Partners. There is a name that you need to be looking at that looks really exciting. This is a Rackspace Incorporated, ticker symbol RAX. These guys claim to be the world leader in internet hosting, which is actually a pretty profitable business to be in. The company is making money. The deal is managed by Goldman Sachs, and Goldman actually does a pretty good job of getting the stock placed with people who want to own it, which in turn basically sends the stock higher, because people who want to own the stock aren't going to sell it unless you sell it at a premium, and it's just a great recipe for an upward trending stock. So I think Rackspace is one to keep on your list. There's going to be a 15 million shares price. They're going to price it between $12 and $16. And if I were looking at this deal, I would watch for it to price at 16 or above. I think it's going to price at the high end of the range, which would be a good sign that there's demand for the stock. I think it's worth buying in the aftermarket, but only if you can get it at an attractive price. I would not buy on a gap higher. In other words, if it prices at 16 and starts trading at 25, you don't want to buy it there. But this is one to give it 2 to 3 weeks to let it consolidate. And then once it kind of builds a little bit of a pattern and shakes out most of the weak holders, then that'd be a great time to step in and buy some for the long term and ride this thing higher. We'll definitely keep an eye on it. I'll be watching it, and you can keep track of it at zachstocks.com, where I have my blog, and I would love it if you paid me a visit. That's zachstocks.com. And Andrew, we will talk again next week. Thanks.
Hey, thanks so much, Zach. And I do encourage you to check out Zach's great blog. It's really, I think it's a great amount of insight, and I had a few people email me last week. A few people were really aggravated because they missed the boat on Chipotle that Zach had talked about shorting, and boy, was that down pretty substantial. So I think there's great insight there, and he does run a hedge fund, by the way, that deals really with new issues and IPOs and companies that really haven't been around. I think it's only a few years, and he's pretty good, I think. I don't think he really talks about it very much because it's not in the, you know, you can't do so. You can't broadcast your returns when it comes to a hedge fund. But I think if my memory serves me correctly, you know what? Hang on. I'm going to actually get those numbers. All right, here they are. So check this out. So year to date through the end of July, the Stearman Capital is up about 11.93%, which compares to the S&P, which is negative 13.5% or so. And for the month of July, a pretty awful month overall, you know, kind of focus on a few areas, but the hedge fund did 4.04% and the S&P did negative 1%. So pretty substantial returns. Anyway, I do encourage you to do that. And of course, I just put out a whole bunch of things for you. Please do me a favor. And if you want to follow me, first of all, on Twitter, it's Andrew Horowitz, trying to bring those numbers up. I'm going to be visiting Leo Laporte next week. And I don't want to be embarrassed by showing him only a few hundred. So if you have Twitter, add me to your Twitter, Andrew Horowitz. Add me to Facebook, you can too, because I kind of go and talk there every once in a while about a few things. And I'd love to have you as a friend. And finally, do me a favor, if you have the opportunity to visit the Disciplined Investor, plenty of ideas there for you. And I think that you'll find a couple of little nuggets in there from here to there. And of course, all the information about the show is on the show notes. So that's about it. For this episode, next week, Barry Ritholtz is scheduled, one of the, as they call it, the A-bloggers. And the big picture is his blog. I think that he's going to be quite interesting. So we'll see you around next week. And so long for now. This is Andrew Horowitz on The Disciplined Investor, episode 68, signing off. Thanks so much for joining me.
The Disciplined Investor podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.